Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It seems pretty obvious that if a parent has overdosed on drugs the night before, the child will not be 100% ready to learn in school the next day. In fact, they may be distracted, disruptive, or difficult. And some New Hampshire educators are seeing more of this among their students, they say, due to the opioid crisis. But how to help those kids? This year, six districts will tackle that question through an approach called Trauma-Informed Services. It offers training for teachers and other school staff on better understanding students who experience disturbing, even frightening events, and what to do for that child so he or she can continue to learn. We're finding out more today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests with us. Dave Levesque, principal of Pleasant Street Elementary School in Laconia, voted the 2017 Elementary School of the Year. Dave helped create the We Connect mentorship program that supports kids with trauma. He's also been a vice principal at the high school level. And Dave, really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Lauren Romanoskis. She's the school nurse at Hudson Memorial Middle School. Lauren, good to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also with us, Cassie Yackley, psychologist with the Center for Behavioral Health Innovation at Antioch University in New England. She specializes in childhood trauma. She's been working with the New Hampshire Department of Education to implement trauma-informed services in schools around the state. And Cassie, I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Well, unfortunately, all of you, you know, some kids have always had trauma in the home, domestic violence, alcohol abuse. Dave, what are you seeing right now at your school? What's changed?
I think for the first time, the stuff that was dealt with in the community is being dealt with in the schools. We are seeing kids coming to school that have witnessed an overdose, who are homeless, who have seen things that I hope I never have to see or any of our kids have to see, and they're coming to school, and that's a safe haven for them. What we discovered is we have to figure out a way to support their needs. And how can you learn if you're just witnessed an overdose or a domestic violence incident? How can you learn? So part of our job is to educate ourselves through helping with the help of Cassie Ackley, and also educating our teachers on how to support kids. And not only the kids, we're seeing more families that are looking for our support every day in the school.
So what's changed over the years that you've been an educator at the high school and now at the elementary level?
I think things in the past were dealt with at home, and parents wanted nothing. They didn't want the schools to know what was happening. Now the stuff is coming directly to the schools, to the school counselors, to the principals, to the classroom teachers. Things that were once held private and confidential are now out there. You know, with the use of social media, with information that we have and relationships we have with the police and the fire, we're working together to solve some of these problems that the kids are having.
So is that a positive, Dave, where at least you know the child is having a problem at home?
It is for us because we want to help the kid learn, but we're not only there to help them learn. We have to support them in learning through education about how to communicate, how to be a good human being, how to live in a community that has the struggles that all of our communities have. So it's a new challenge, but it's one that we're excited about because if we can create good citizens at the kindergarten and first grade level, we're hopefully that by the time we get to high school, we're out into the workforce, they're ready for the world.
Well, and you mentioned guidance counselors. And a little bit later in the show, we will talk to a guidance counselor in Laconia. How about you, Lauren? What are you seeing?
We're definitely seeing an increase in physical symptoms in children as a direct result of the stress that they have at home. Oftentimes we'll have kids that come in with headaches or they're just really tired. And when you talk to them, they were up all night with a parent or they, you know, had a ton of sleep disruption due to, you know, personal things that are happening at the home. And so they're not getting the support at home that they need, and they're looking to the schools to help meet their physical and emotional needs.
So they come into you and they say, you know, Ms. Romanoskis, I have a headache. I have a stomach ache. I can't stay awake. How do you sort of start that process, Lauren, of trying to figure out like what is really going on?
Well, it comes down to basic nursing assessment. It's looking at a kid and figuring out, do you have a fever? You know, did you have breakfast this morning? Did you get a good night's sleep? What did you do? What time did you go to bed? What do you sleep in at home? You know, do you have your own bed? Do you share a room with a sibling? You know, do you everybody sleep in one room? You know, those are very real situations that our kids are in. Sometimes there's no food at home. So we have a before school breakfast program that really helps meet the needs of our kids so that they're ready to learn because they have full bellies. So we can always send a kid down to get, you know, an English muffin and some toast from my fabulous cafeteria folks. So we really do try to make sure that they have all their physical needs met so that they can learn. And frankly, sometimes kids just need a nap. So a lot of times we'll schedule quiet time in the office. I have a great office space that has the ability to dim the lights and give kids a moment to regroup psychologically and physically.
So you're doing a physical and also an emotional examination, really, Lauren.
Absolutely. And for me, it's about knowing my kids. I have 870-ish kids at Memorial.
Wow, that's a lot of kids.
Yes. And it doesn't take me very long to figure out who are my groupies, my kids that need some extra love and attention. And once we sort of figure out the patterns, we can then work with the teachers to figure out, is it something that's happening in the classroom that's why I'm seeing this kid so frequently? Or is it something at home that they maybe need a little bit more additional support?
So how long have you been in the schools, Lauren?
I have been at Memorial for 7 years.
And what changes have you seen over that time in terms of the issues that kids are bringing to you?
We definitely have seen an increase in a lot of physical symptoms of stress. You know, we'll see definitely a lot more headaches, a lot more fatigue, muscle aches and pains. You know, kids will come in and just be like, I ache. And you're like, well, what'd you do? And they don't know. You know, they just are not, they don't feel well. And a lot of times that's the physical symptoms of stress. And I've seen stress do amazing things to children that you just would not expect. And I've seen kids break out in rashes before a stressful test. And that those types of small little physical responses can be very unsettling for kids.
Yeah, and stress reactions before a test, you know, adults listening might think, oh, yeah, you know, I remember. But now, I mean, you are seeing the impacts of the opioid crisis. And I just can't even imagine being a kid and going to school when the parent has overdosed the night before.
Absolutely. And that whole grief process can be very complicated for kids because they don't want to be like, hey, my mom overdosed or my mom, you know, my dad, you know, isn't around because he's in jail because he had a drug issue. So those kids really, sometimes they're out there and they'll tell you exactly what happened. But other times you have to be a little bit of a detective. And we work very closely with our police and fire in our town. And just to make sure that they're aware of what families might need some additional extra support.
Well, Cassie, what do we know about the impacts of childhood trauma on learning and behavior, both in that immediate moment and, you know, a couple years down the line?
You know, Laura, we have so much research out there at this point regarding the impacts on the neurodevelopment of a child, which really sets the brain structure and function for the rest of learning and the rest of relationships in their lifetime. And I think primarily of the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study conducted by Andy and Folletti, who really talked about what we know about this connection between early adversity and the association with both neurodevelopmental difficulties, but then also impairment in social, cognitive, and emotional skills, which prepare kids to have relationships with students, to engage their prefrontal cortex or the learning part of their brain. And when you're not able to have that foundation of skills in terms of brain development and in terms of those social, emotional, and cognitive skills again, then you tend not to develop the kind of social resources and relationships and self-concept that you would want to have to set you up to feel good about life later on. And when you're in those circumstances, as we learned from the ACEs study, when you don't have friends and when it's hard to function at school, we tend to engage in risky behaviors as young adolescents and as adolescents. So that might be doing things like coping through self-harming behaviors. It certainly is connected, we know, with increased use of substance abuse and all kinds of mental health issues that predispose someone to, again, the use of all kinds of illicit or alcohol or other substances, and then also to early life disease and disability in terms of long-term functioning.
So we really want to help a young child out with trauma as early as possible, as robustly as possible, not only just out of sympathy, but also because there are, you know, key impacts for that person and society down the road.
Yeah, and I would say out of empathy, right, that we understand so much now about the changes that it makes to our brain for all of us when we have adverse experiences. And we also understand that the vast majority of our population have some kind of adversity within the first 18 years of their life. In fact, what we learned from the ACEs study is about 70% of people will acknowledge having one significant ACE during that period of time.
ACEs again.
Adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And, you know, I just wanted to go back for one moment, if I might. Just my vantage point is a little different than Dave and Lauren. And I think working with schools across our state and mental health providers across our state, I think one of the things I'm seeing is just an increase in really scary behaviors, challenging behaviors such as hurting themselves, hurting others, threatening teachers. And I think the other really important thing about trauma sensitivity is about staff, is about the adults and the impact that has on our ability to feel hopeful about students and our ability to engage with caregivers in meaningful ways, because we all know this is really a cycle. And we have to work, as Dave said, with caregivers and community members and our schools together in a partnership to address this issue.
The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, educating the educators on childhood trauma. This year, about a half a dozen districts will see mental health experts training teachers and other staff to better manage the trauma faced by students, to help them cope and continue learning, and maybe even avoid some of the longer-term impacts that Cassie Yackley describes down the road. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Dave, just getting down to real basics for a moment, how do you get this information that there has been trauma? Lauren talked about how sometimes she found out just through talking to the kids. Do you find out from police? Do you find out from Child Protective Services? Do you find out from the kids? Do you find it from the kids' friends? How do you even figure out that there's something going on?
The quick answer is yes to all of those.
Yeah.
So, again, we rely on our community agencies, DCYF, the police, the fire. But a lot of our most useful information actually comes from the students. I've heard both ladies say is relationships is the key for this process, and having a trusting adult. And what we're finding is our nurse and our guidance counselors are one of those two trusted adults, and our kids are very open about what's happening in their lives. Another way that we did what we did at Pleasant Street School was we did a behavioral survey with the teachers, looking at internalizing conditions, externalizing behavior conditions, and academic concerns. And the teachers were surveyed, and it kind of broke the kids down into areas where we thought, what do all of our students need? How can we support them? And how can we figure out a way to support everybody who has a need? So our teachers were active participants to learn more about what's happening in the child's life. They're with the kids 6 hours a day, so they see them. They see what's happening day in and day out. And again, I believe the schools are a safe place for kids to be. And once you have that safe haven, kids are going to open up and share things that are happening. Good, bad, or indifferent, our parents often come in and share information. Hey, this happened last night. this is what's going on in my life. Here's what the situation is. And again, I think we're seeing caregivers that were once adult now are five and six and seven-year-olds. They're the caregivers at the home making sure baby brother eats. They're the caregivers to make sure mom is okay if something goes bad.
Wow, that's a lot for a kid.
It is. And again, that's when they come in tired and exhausted and they're not feeling well and they're having these symptoms. We're going, okay, let's start trying to figure out how to connect the dots. And again, so we've put strategies in place at our school to figure out who they are, and let's communicate as a group and figure out how we can wrap this kid up. How can we wrap this child up so we can support them? How can you learn if your life is that way, you know, from 3 o'clock to 8 a.m. the next day? So again, we're seeing the switch of caregivers being, you know, like I said, 6-7-year-olds that are having to be responsible to make breakfast, to get to school, to dress themselves, to shower. And again, I think that's happening all over the state of New Hampshire.
So, Lauren, and back to you, Dave, too. Lauren, what do you do for a kid like that who's, you know, 8 years old and is taking care of a baby while worrying about mom, you know, overdosing again? I mean, how do you even get started with that?
We actually see that a lot on the middle school level because they're just a smidge older and can do that very successfully for parents. And so we see a lot of tardies and chronic absenteeism. So as a district, we made a commitment to make sure that we're tracking chronic tardies and chronic absenteeism so that we can really target those kids for extra intervention and support and figure out, why are you always late? Is it because you missed the bus because you're trying to get your elementary aged sibling ready? And so if we can figure out the why of a student's concern, then hopefully we can offer some solutions. And sometimes it's the understanding of, all right, let's put, you know, your unified arts class, not to diminish the importance of PE and art and stuff, but let's put that first so that we make sure that you're getting your core education classes.
So, and Dave, I can see you want to jump in, but so that's an, you know, a quick fix, but more broadly, I mean, what do you do, Lauren? Do you call up the parents and say, look, this, you know, your kid is struggling and you need to figure this out?
Frankly, we send out a series of letters, and it starts, you know, when your student has missed, I believe it's 6 days, and then it goes from there based on your level of a student's attendance issues. And we actually have an attendance committee that will meet and talk about specific students' needs depending upon their level of absenteeism so that we make sure, do they need tutoring? Do they need extra directed studies and extra support? You know, do they have unmet learning needs and potentially a disability that is starting to manifest itself in middle school as the work becomes harder and as they don't have that one or two teachers like they have at the elementary level who can help, you know, give them support and really know them as a student? When they come to middle school, they all of a sudden have all these different classes and have to move through these very crowded halls in 45, 50-minute intervals. And so we attempt...
It's a lot more to manage.
It is. It's, you know, you have backpacks and books and binders where at
lockers
the end, exactly getting into that locker combination can be very stressful for a middle schooler.
Go ahead, David, you want to jump in?
Yeah, so fortunately at Laconia, or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, is through our Office of School Wellness, we saw a need for these kids who are missing school, who are having these other issues, and we have hired social workers that are working in the building. So for at our three elementary schools, we share two social workers. So there are front lines now when a student isn't showing up or we're expecting something or a DCYF report comes or there's a police blotter. That's our first line. They're going out to the homes to visit the family, to get the kid, to drive them to school, to make sure they have clothes, food, water, everything they need.
Well, coming up, we will talk to a guidance counselor. And Cassie, I have another question for you about trauma and brain development. So we'll tackle all that in just a moment. After a short break, this is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, educating school staff about childhood trauma, given a rising number of New Hampshire students experiencing parental drug use and even overdose in the home. We're asking how teachers and others can keep the learning on track, support these students, and recognizing what they're going through. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Tell us what you've noticed in your own community, or if you have questions or comments about this approach. We'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Dave Levesque, principal of Pleasant Street Elementary School in Laconia. He's also been a vice principal at the high school, and Dave has been very active in creating some of these mentorship programs that support kids who've experienced trauma. Lauren Romanowskis is also with us. She's a school nurse at Hudson Memorial School. That's a middle school. Along with Cassie Yackley, psychologist with the Center for Behavioral Health Innovation at Antioch University, New England. And she's been working for many years on trauma-informed services in schools. And Cassie, to you too, I'd love your thoughts on the conversation we had with Dave and Lauren just before the break about, okay, you find out a kid has experienced trauma, then what do you do?
Yeah, I think this is a really important conversation. I want to just take us even a step back, because I do think the first part of this intervention is what you started asking about, is how do we know this information? And one of the things that I've noticed across a lot of systems, the community mental health system and schools, et cetera, is that two things that swirl around trauma are shame and blame. And that's also true about substance abuse, which in most cases, there's an underlying foundation of some type of traumatic experience. So as they would say in the trauma world, what we're beginning to do is speak the unspeakable. And I often say to people that we have a habit in our school system and a lot of our systems right now of talking about bad behaviors that we know from the sciences at this point are really driven by adverse or traumatic experiences. So the very act of partnering with caregivers, partnering with schools, partnering with children to say, what's happened in your life and how has that impacted your ability to come to school, to be happy, and to develop friendships? Because that simple understanding that our behavior communicates something and that we are not our behavior, those are communication about our experiences in life. So asking parents, asking kids this conversation about what happened to you can allow them not to harbor the shame that's often associated
with
these
experiences. It's not my
fault. Exactly. It's
not my fault. Kids do that. They blame themselves.
Your behavior makes sense given your experiences, which leads us to the next part of what do we do with this? And I think, again, first of it is helping our world understand what adversity does to our brain. The next part about that is helping people to understand their bodies, as Lauren was talking about, to learn to engage in self-regulation, our ability to calm our body down, or our ability to use other people to feel safe, which we call attachment, and to use other people to help ourselves calm down, which is some of the dynamics that Lauren and Dave are talking about and that we're working with educators across the state to develop that capacity.
So Dave and Lauren talked about the importance of a trusted individual, especially when there's violence and trauma in the home. Given, you know, kids are at school a lot, but they have a lot of other hours not at school, can a safe haven at school, a trusted teacher, a trusted nurse like Lauren, can that actually, Cassie, prevent or even reverse some of the brain effects that trauma creates? I mean, can you actually create healthier neural, emotional, psychological pathways through having somebody you love and trust at school?
Yes, it's amazing what we know now. And if you look at the factors that contribute to our resiliency, the other side of adversity, we know that two things I speak a lot with people about. One is the presence of at least one supportive relationship. And educators are in a beautiful position to be that kind of relationship. And the other piece is a sense of hope, the ability to feel hopeful about our future. And primarily that happens in the context of a relationship in which we feel safe, in which we know that somebody has what they would say unconditional positive regard for us, that we're worthy as humans in this world of figuring out our experiences and having the best shot at being successful.
Let's go to the phones. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, we're going to bring another voice into our conversation. Molly Greeley is with us, guidance counselor for Woodland Heights Elementary School in Laconia. And Molly, welcome to The Exchange. Really nice to have you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on this morning.
Well, as a guidance counselor, Molly, what types of situations are you helping kids with?
You know, we're helping students with a whole multitude of situations at this point. We see students who are dealing with all types of things at home, and that's not a brand new experience for our school, but I would say that it's definitely increased in the recent history. We are a school that has approximately 75% of our students who receive free and reduced lunch. So there's been a lot of different factors that have affected our students over the years, but definitely seeing some changes with the current opioid crisis. We see a whole host of things happening, from students who are struggling to be successful in the school with their learning, students who are struggling with that self-regulation piece, and then some real systemic changes, things at home, lots of students living in different types of situations that they weren't before, and a lot of instability that's affecting what they're able to do in the school setting.
So are kids couch surfing? Not really sure, you know, where they may spend the night?
Absolutely. In addition to my role as the guidance counselor here at Woodland Heights, I also serve as our school district's homeless education liaison, which means I support our students without secure housing throughout our entire school district. And I would say for certain that I, in the past year especially, have had more families who have nowhere to go at the end of a day. They've used all the resources available in our amazing community that's trying to support people, and they literally are ending the day without anywhere to go. They have been sleeping on couches. There are no couches left. The shelters are full. And that's become a very scary and real experience, and not one that I think we really faced to that level until this past school year.
So how do you get kids, Molly, to open up about these situations? You know, you probably heard Cassie a moment ago talk about shame and blame.
Yeah. I think, first of all, our work with Cassie has helped all of us within our school district to understand, you know, the effects of trauma and toxic stress on our students, and helped us see the need to create that trust. I think that trust is really what can help students begin to open up with us, to see that we are a safe place, that we are a caring place, that we love them for who they are, not what they do. And I believe that when they start to see that, then they realize they can let us see the parts of themselves that they are so scared of and so uncomfortable and ashamed of, as Cassie mentioned. And we can see that, and we can hold that for them, and they can see that they're a still loved and good person, even though they have these parts of themselves that they are so ashamed about.
How much can you, as a guidance counselor, Molly, communicate with a teacher, given privacy rules, about what a particular student is going through?
Well, often I work with the family or the caregivers to talk about what they're comfortable with other people knowing. So, for example, if I have a grandparent who has taken guardianship of a student because the parent is struggling with substance abuse, I'll discuss with the grandparent, are you comfortable with me sharing some of this with the teacher? And often or almost always the response is yes, because they know that it helps the child for the teacher to have a better overall understanding. But I think that we also try to impress upon our teachers that we try not to lower expectations or create a different school set of expectations for these students, because continuing that hope also means keeping that high level of expectation for children. So I guess when it comes to confidentiality, what I try to share with teachers, as much as I think it's helpful for them to help the student be successful in school. And that really depends on the situation and what the family is comfortable with people knowing.
And so getting back to what you said earlier, that's real interesting. You know, letting the teacher know that, look, this kid is really dealing with, you know, something very difficult, you know, couch surfing or parental drug abuse. But on the other hand, like, don't let him or her off the hook academically. You know, keep pushing, in other words.
Yeah, keep trying. That doesn't mean that all children are capable of learning. All human beings are capable of growing. And we don't change that just because children have had traumatic experiences in their background. I am so amazingly impressed and proud of the staff here in Laconia, and I directly see it on a day-to-day basis here at Woodland Heights, and how they're willing to take in this concept of children who are coming from such, you know, concerning situations and help them thrive here in the school setting. So that comes from the child knowing that that teacher cares about who they are and fully believes that they can succeed. And when someone else believes that about us, it helps us to start believing it about ourselves, and it helps students be able to keep taking those steps forward towards learning.
Well,
learning is so much about taking risks. It's about putting yourself out there. And if the world has taught you to feel shameful of who you are, it's really hard to take that risk. But when you're in a classroom with a teacher who looks at you and you know that he or she loves you, cares about you, and is going to support you, whether you get that answer right or wrong, you're going to be more willing to take some of those risks.
Well, and Cassie told us, you know, about amazing research that actually shows that when there is that care and love that you talk about, Molly, you can actually improve some of these traumatic effects on the brain. What success stories have you seen, Molly, where you were really able to help someone? Obviously, I know you can't give, you know, names, but I'd love to just hear a story where, you know, you feel like you really made a difference.
Sure, absolutely. We, you know, we have a lot of students who've been through a lot of things here. I can think of one situation where we had a student who was in a home where there was a good amount of domestic violence and substance abuse going on. One of the parents was incarcerated, and through all of that happening, the child was just reeling from all of that in school. The incarcerated parent has returned to the community and is attempting to create a stable environment, but that light switch doesn't flip for kids. They don't automatically see that parent come home and everything's all better. Obviously, there's a lot that has to happen. So in conjunction with that parent coming home and doing everything that he possibly could on his end, we also created a safe place here for the child where we met her needs in a very specific and individualized type of way. There was a lot of self-harming type behavior going on, and that was very concerning. So we sat with the classroom teacher and the parent and created a safety plan on what we would do. We also provided a lot of support and instruction for that child on how to handle those dysregulated emotions and what to do when she feels those starting to come on. And, you know, very quickly into the year, I would say we were able to reduce any instances of self-harm, and that student was able to maintain and be in the classroom on a regular basis. And I would say that's the success of our team working together, but I would put most of that success on her classroom teacher, who was there through the tough, challenging moments, you know, held her when she cried, let her have what she needed, and then got her back on track. And also her parent, who has returned to the community and is working as hard as possible with us and all community resources to help that child be successful.
All right, Molly, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Molly Greeley, guidance counselor for Woodland Heights Elementary School in Laconia. The number for you to join us with your comments, questions, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Dave, how about you? Again, without revealing specific personal data, what successes have you seen from this approach of, you know, recognizing the trauma, understanding it, and trying to work with it?
Molly hit everything perfectly. I don't think I could have said it any better. I think the way that as an administrator, we work with kids is different now. We don't want to send kids home. We want them in the school. So if a kid acts out in a classroom, one of the jobs that we have to do is figure out why are they acting out. And our communication is maybe they need to take a yoga break. Maybe they need to do some deep breathing. Maybe they just need to take a break. They can go visit a different teacher. Get to the root of what's happening and get them back into the classroom. We want them in the building. We had a student who a year ago who was homeless and was back and forth, and every day I don't think she said a word the entire year. Just was there. You knew she was there physically. But through our work with her and communicating with the teacher and the teacher just building this positive relationship with her, she now is glowing, happy to be at school. And an active participant. In fact, ironically, the mom stopped in the school yesterday to drop off some paperwork, and the mom is glowing and happy and said, "I can't wait for my daughter to come back into school." because of the relationships and the time we spent with her and the mom and supporting her through the social worker and through time in the classroom, the school now is not something that's scary. It's something that's welcoming. The mom never came into our building. Now, yesterday, she walks in the building and says, here's my paperwork. My daughter's ready to go. So things like that are little successes, but they mean a lot to us.
Well, it's a lot for teachers, isn't it, Dave? I mean, a lot of people get into education because they care about kids, but they want to educate. So this is a whole another sort of set of skills that they need to acquire.
Yeah, and I think what a residual effect of our work in working with kids with trauma is, how do we support teachers? I remember picking the phone up to call Cassie and say, Cassie, what do we do when a kid discloses this during our We Connect time? What do we do? How does a teacher take that information, and what do they do with it? We just had a 5-year-old say something or a 7-year-old say something, and the teacher now has that weight on her shoulders. What do we do?
In addition to testing and lesson plans and all the other stuff that they have to do.
So we had a PD after school, and talking with Kathy, and I said it was open to anybody who wanted to come, had no expectations, no requirements. I said, here's what's happening. Here's what it's about. 28 teachers showed up to listen to Cassie talk for 2 hours about how to support themselves as teachers and how to support kids.
Well, and we're going to have a whole teacher roundtable tomorrow, actually, not just talking about this, but just their hopes and dreams and concerns for the incoming year. So, Cassie, go ahead. I mean, we've talked a lot about the kids and the families, but what about the teachers? They've got a lot on their plate already.
They most certainly do. I think we have higher and higher expectations academically. And if I can try to say this in as short as piece as I can, one of the things that we've learned from the field of social neuroscience is that all of us are deeply impacted by the feelings and the beliefs of other people. And the way in which that happens is that we develop something called mirror neurons. And they are neurons in our brain that literally resonate with or fire in sync with another person. And so when we have a child or a caregiver who's experienced significant trauma, it's not only the challenging behavior they're dealing with, it's their constant exposure to that child's emotions and negative beliefs. And that process is called emotion contagion. So part of what we're talking with people about is being aware of this literal, fundamental interconnectedness of us as humans and ways in which to mitigate the impacts of being exposed to distressed kids and
distressed circumstances. Well, that's really interesting, sure. And on one hand, you want teachers to be connected, to provide that warm, loving atmosphere. But I've heard about this also with, you know, EMTs and firefighters. You know, you care about the people that you're trying to rescue. But on the other hand, you have that, and I can't remember the technical term, but you have that connection, and it's exhausting.
Yes, and I actually work with police departments as well and mental health providers and a variety of other disciplines around this same phenomenon. And this is the beautiful part about it. When we know about this, we have the power to positively impact the emotions and the beliefs of another person. And on the flip side of that, if we don't maintain awareness and reflect and think about the impact of this kind of exposure, then it can begin to impact us as a human. And we can begin to feel hopeless about students or about ourselves, or begin to feel sad or negative in ways. So it's an awareness of this process that really allows us to, again, mitigate the impacts.
All right, I'm super interested in that. We're going to follow up after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls, too. So join us at 1-800-892-6477. A couple emails I want to share. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Keep it right here.
This week on the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, author Michael Cunningham has advice we can all take to heart, no matter what you do.
You have to figure out when it's time to just let it go, when this is all you can do. Over the years, I have developed a slightly better sense of when I've reached that point, when in rewriting, I'm not making it better, but I'm just making it different.
Subscribe to the podcast for sage advice or find some at nhpr.org/10mww.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're getting up to speed on what's called trauma-informed services in the schools. Educators say more New Hampshire students are experiencing parental drug use and even overdose at home. We're asking how schools try to support those kids and even keep their learning on track. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Dave, Lauren, and Cassie, let's go to our listeners. Jay joins us from Dover. Hi, Jay. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, good morning. I love your show. First time I called. I'll be quick. I think it's fantastic about the guidance counselors in elementary school recognizing signs that may not be obvious because of, possible traumas at home. I just wanted to share that it's the importance of having that, recognizing trauma at all school ages. When I was a junior at Boston University, my younger brother overdosed and died.
Jay, I'm so sorry. How horrible.
It is horrible. And they never teach you in elementary, middle, high school, what to do when your brother dies or, so I actually had to take a leave of absence. And it took me a good year to finish my degree, a good year extra, I should say. So because I took a full year off, and there was no grief counselors there, nobody that can say like, oh, you should do this or you shouldn't do that or take, so you just... You don't know what to do. So I just wanted to emphasize the importance at all ages, especially in schools, to be able to deal with or to be able to help the students deal with whatever's going on at home in the personal life.
Wow. Jay, thank you so much for your call. And I'm really sorry to hear about what happened to you. That's terrible. Thank you for sharing your story, Jay.
Much.
Yeah. And Lauren, we've talked a lot about, kids who are dealing with homelessness or having to be the parent to younger siblings or drug overdoses. But there's also just, there are parents who die. There are siblings who die. I mean, I'm sure you've dealt with situations like this.
Unfortunately, a few years ago, we did have a student that passed away after a very public battle with brain cancer, Mackenzie Lowe. And last year would have been her eighth grade graduation. So we actually had to revisit again that grief process with those students and talk about how to appropriately grieve again. And, here they were graduating and happy, but we also had Kenzie's empty chair.
Oh,
and the awareness that grief is ongoing. It's not something that you deal with just today or just this week. It's something that can touch you for the rest of your life. And kids need to be aware of that. They need to know that it's okay to still feel sad and to still be upset. And ways to manage that grief in a healthy way.
Do you think schools are a little more up to speed on this than they used to be? Because our caller, Jay, now he was in college, but seems like he was kind of just left out there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have a whole preparedness plan in place. And, there's a system that is unfortunately very fine-tuned in terms of making sure that administrators and teachers are notified and that the staff as well have the support that they need to meet the needs of the kids and to have, frankly, enough tissues and enough people to sit with kids and to be there when they need you.
Here's an email from Jen in Franklin that came in. Jen says, I teach at Franklin High School. I've worked with Cassie. She says, you're second to none, Cassie. She says, the issue of ACE, again, that's
adverse childhood experience,
is truly the elephant in the room. She says, I really hope that every school district can begin to put this work front and center as it affects everyone. Jen says, it's critically important for all the adults working with students to understand the effects of trauma so we can find better ways to connect with our students and connect them with their own innate talents. Jen says, it's also important for us as adults to understand how all of this affects us as well so we find ways to support ourselves too. And that's the point that we were starting to get at before the break, Cassie. So I wonder if you want to just add a little bit more to that, how, trauma affects not just the kids, but also the adults that work and care for these children.
Yeah, in a number of different ways. I think you can look at our societal level of violence and of trauma, and those can have the impacts of something called systematic desensitization, that the more you're exposed to upsetting things, the less you have the emotional reaction to it. And then the flip, as we were talking about earlier with regard to teachers, is that we know through a process that they call emotion contagion, that when we spend time with others who are in distress, if we're attuned with them, meaning we are trying to understand their experiences and how they feel about those experiences, that will have an impact on our own emotions and our own belief systems about three things: about ourselves and whether we believe we're worthy of love and belonging in this world. Number two, about other people, whether we believe other people can be trusted ultimately. And third, whether the world is a good place or a bad place. And they refer to that dynamic as the negative cognitive triad. And it's, in fact, the fourth criterion to post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think most people have a good understanding about the typical criterion, which include, some kind of exposure, re-experiencing of the event, trigger responses, nightmares, remembering. Number two, avoidance, doing anything you can do not to think about or remember those events. Number three, hyperarousal or hypervigilance, feeling keyed up, feeling irritable, feeling on edge because your stress response system is chronically activated.
Because you're constantly dealing
constantly.
With this.
Constantly. The more insidious impact is this fourth criterion, and it's more associated with complex trauma, which I think many of these families that we're talking about are families that struggle with complex trauma. And that, again, is these beliefs that develop that we are largely unaware of that tell us we're not worthy of love and belonging, other people can't be trusted, and the world's a bad place. And just to sum that up, that belief system, that negative belief system, if we are not talking about it and being aware of it, can begin to infiltrate, if you will, that teacher's experience, that educator's experience, that mental health provider's or police officer's
And then they don't do as good a job reaching out to the kids who need help. It's so interesting to hear teachers undergoing some of the same sort of cognitive stress downward spirals that we hear, first responders
Absolutely.
Go through.
And we need to remember that we're not just talking about the adverse experiences of the students we're working with. If what we know from the ACEs study, again, is that about 70% of our population have had one exposure. And so we're also talking about educators. And what we know from the research is that those involved in the helping professions typically have more adversity in their lives than those who do not. So it's not only those experiences that they're facing with the students, but for many people, it's their own experiences that are being reawakened via their exposure to these students and families.
Well, so personal question, Lauren. I mean, how do you sort of manage this yourself? You talked about the students that you help, and I'm sure you do an amazing job, but you're a very caring person. But how do you kind of manage that for yourself so that you're like ready to go every day?
In my office, we talk a lot about self-care.
I bet.
And I work a lot with my teachers as well in making sure that they're doing what they need to make sure that they stay sane, frankly. And I, as a general rule, I don't live in my district. So I will tell you that helps because I go home to someplace else and a different, totally different world. So I can sort of emotionally distance myself in that way. But frankly, it is hard. We walk a lot. we try to promote the good exercise habits and good eating, healthy eating, and caring for yourself. When you're sick, go to the doctor and don't just suffer in silence, to seek other people's advice and opinions and to talk about these experiences and these shared experiences.
Well, here's an email from Ken who says, peer counseling programs really helped my high school in California. Ken says they detected issues early, allowed for kids to trust their trained peers. Ken says, I was one of them, and we talked with 800 referrals a year. When there were significant issues arose, then a trained counselor or faculty member intervened. Ken says, huge success. So you're kind of doing this, right, Dave, in Laconia?
I guess to a certain extent. We developed a program once we figured out or discovered all the amount of trauma going on, called a program called We Connect. The idea was basically to have a secondary adult in the building that a student could go to. Based on the talking with Cass, he's saying we can reverse the effects of trauma if they have a caring and relationship with another adult. So again, I threw this out to the teachers. All of a sudden, 13 teachers showed up and said, yes, let's do this. So we created small groups, K through 2, and then 3 through 5, and they were 30 minutes long, once a week on a waterfall schedule.
What does that mean, waterfall schedule?
So 1 week it was at 9, the next week it was at 9:30, the next week it was at 10.
So they didn't miss math or English.
Right, exactly. So we thought about all the parameters and what we could do to support kids. So we didn't know how it was going to go, and when we did this for 9 weeks, and the results were incredible. The teachers loved it. The kids loved it. There were more positive things happening in the building because of it. It got to the point where the kids were asking, when is our next We Connect group? Because they wanted to meet with their new friends. They wanted to meet with their new teacher who they had a relationship with. The other piece that was interesting is the kids, when things got difficult for a kid in their regular classroom, the student would go visit their We Connect person. So now they had a secondary adult in the building that they had built a relationship with. So it morphed into something that we never thought would happen. And it's to the point now that we're doing it twice next year, 2 7-week sessions. We're sorting the kids out. And again, it's building these different relationships. And when I surveyed the kids, 99% said they want to have it back next year. They want it back.
So they didn't feel embarrassed, I have special problems. I have to go to a special place. Because older kids, they really don't want to be the different kid.
Right. And I think that's when we have students that have higher levels of need based on trauma. But we as a school didn't want to isolate kids. We wanted to incorporate all 300 of our students and said, we're all doing this together. And the residual effect is you have a second grade student high-fiving a kindergarten student going down the hallway saying, that's in my We Connect group.
So is everybody in a We Connect group?
Everybody.
I see.
So it's that high school model of advisory. We took it down to the elementary school level, K through 5, all 300 students. Each teacher has between 8 and 12 students in their group. Everybody in the building other than myself and the secretary and the custodian have kids. So if I'm a para, I'm a special ed teacher, I'm a classroom teacher, I have 8 to 12 kids that I'm building a relationship with for those 7 weeks.
And what do you do? Do you just sort of sit everybody down and say, okay, sharing time?
It started out that way.
A little awkward for
kids.
It
is. But what we found is our teachers are trained in responsive classroom, so they had some skills already. What we found out is that the teachers wanted more. And the kids wanted more. So the program, through the help of with Cassie, is it's morphed into a program of 7 weeks where we're actually going to design 3 weeks of lesson plans for the teachers. So we have a school-wide theme. And then 4 weeks of the teachers doing individual things with a culminating activity. An example of a culminating activity last year is that I had every student put a handprint and they cut it out and they drew something positive they wanted. And we connected the hands throughout the school. So, and again, the teachers... 30 minutes was not enough. They wanted 40. So we had to up it to 40 minutes because they felt the importance of the program. So it's morphed and we've seen the importance. Ironically, there were no discipline behaviors or referrals the entire time during the We Connect group.
Wow. So making that connection Absolutely. About not about academics or, you know, homework or whatever, just let's connect. Let's check in with you as a human being.
Absolutely. That's the key right there.
Okay. So middle school. Lauren, something happens in middle school. People are a little less open, a little less happy to share, a little more sarcastic, a lot more eye rolls. So what do you think?
We are very lucky to have an in-house partnership with the YMCA that actually provides a classroom experience for kids that they can rotate into and out of as part of their unified arts curriculum. And it's really designed to teach social skills to kids, how to converse with another student, positive self-esteem, awareness of those self-regulating behaviors that can help calm them in a stress response, and an awareness of emotions and how to process them. And it's a whole curriculum that was designed in conjunction with the YMCA to have these kids come into the classroom, meet with Erin Mitchell, who is our YMCA facilitator. And she's that extra person who can provide support and go-to for these kids. And it's just a wonderful program.
Well, here's an email from Kim who says, thank you so much for your informative program on trauma and students. I work as a speech-language pathologist in a Central New Hampshire special education preschool program. Kim says, we often have children in our program who demonstrate behaviors that likely reflect trauma and parental attachment concerns. Frequently, parents are struggling with personal and economic challenges. Kim says, while we have the support of behavior specialists in our program, we don't have embedded social services or family supports. Can your panel members suggest where we might start in addressing home concerns and recommending community supports for stressed out families with young preschoolers? Kim, thank you so much for the email. Can you help her get started, Cassie?
Sure. I mean, I think one issue is finding funding and building support to bring in social workers. And I think that's a larger conversation at a district level that maybe Dave would speak to. But I'm really glad that that email came in, because I do want to say that we've worked very hard in the state to develop evidence-based treatments, psychotherapy treatments for trauma. And one of the treatments that is incredibly hopeful that we've been fortunate to bring into the state through the support of the Endowment for Health and the H&H Foundation is called child-parent psychotherapy. And it works with children 0 to 6 years of age who've experienced trauma. And the really important thing about child-parent psychotherapy is that we're not meeting with children alone, that we're working with caregivers to understand their own childhood attachment or relationship experiences and trauma as it relates to their relationship with their child and their ability to parent their child. It's not a quick fix. It's a year-long treatment, but it has incredible success across our nation and across the world at this point in time in terms of buffering the effects and decreasing the likelihood of getting involved again in child protection services for those kinds of things. So I want people to know there are effective treatments widely disseminated across the state.
And as you said, address the childhood trauma early, because it only expands from there on out.
And behavior with the caregiver.
Okay. All of you, there's so much more we could have talked about. Good luck with the new school year. I really appreciate you coming in. Cassie, it was good to meet you.
Thank you for your time.
That's Cassie Yackley, psychologist with the Center for Behavioral Health Innovation at Antioch University, New England in Keene. Dave, thank you so much for being here. Dave Levesque, principal of Pleasant Street Elementary School in Laconia, which was, as Dave told us, voted the 2017 Elementary School of the Year. And Lauren Romanowskis, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Lauren Romanowskis, school nurse at Hudson Memorial Middle School. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.